It's that spring again, and it's that man again.
It's that man again, yes, that man again, yes, and Tommy Handy is here.
Proving that in addition to being a philanderer of fictitious philanthropy, an organizer of outrageous assemblies, this impresario still remains...
Mother's pride and joy, Mrs. Handy's boy, for it's useless to complain.
The signature tune of an almost legendary BBC radio comedy show which sustained literally millions of Britons during the dark days of World War II. ITMAR, short for It's That Man Again, starred, or perhaps one should say happened around, a Liverpool comedian named Tommy Handley. And it comes from the tingle list of one of the most successful and individual novelists writing today, Beryl Bainbridge. Is this the thrill of a good deed shining in a naughty world?
No, I think that's going a bit far, Robin. It's not that sort of thing at all. It's just that it's all tied up with childhood and the fact that there were gloomy moments in life, but nothing to do with the war. I mean, there was a war going on in our house domestically, so it wasn't the outer world that I was bothered about. But when Tommy Handley came on, spirits got lifted. And it is true that... people, you know, in ordinary life did make remarks about the programme. I mean, you did say to people when you said goodbye to them, TTFN, ta-ta for now. And I remember my father would always say, as we were going out the front door, after you, Claude, and then you said, after you, Cecil.
Yes.
And for years, well, 2 years perhaps, when we used to go on a holiday to Wales, my brother and I wrote scripts on the Tommy Handley thing, nothing very original, and we played all the parts and we put a big curtain up. And I was always Colonel Chinstrap. Do you remember the drunken one?
Yes,
the
I
one
do.
That was always going, oop, like this.
Jack Train, I think, was the actor, wasn't it?
I could never understand why Don't Forget the Diver was so funny. Do you remember, all he ever did was gurgle and disappear, and then just as he went under, he'd say, Don't Forget the Diver, or something like that.
We laughed at different things in those days to the things that amuse us now, didn't we?
Yes, it was. In actual fact, I've listened to them since, and it's not that it's all that funny, but it rushes you along in some way. I don't think I actually liked Tommy Handley himself all that much. He didn't come over as a very warm man. He was almost a bit too hectic, I think, and a bit... It sounded awfully rehearsed.
Looking back to that time, and the difference between then and now, I mean, in those days, people drank tea with their dinner... blimey was a swear word.
Yeah.
To what extent do you think the British character has changed?
Well, if I go back up north now from London and go and see people, there are still pockets in England where people are more, more what I call normal, because I think the English character has changed. I mean, I'm always staggered when I say write something in a novel about those days, and all reviewers now, because they're, in their 30s or 40s, they always pick up on things like how squalid the conditions were, how squalid this character was, because they only had one bath a week. And it's just that people now have forgotten that in those days... It wasn't a question of being squalid. You couldn't afford the hot water. I mean, I think if anything has changed the English character, it's the invention of central heating, of having central heating and hot water.
But your family wasn't what you'd call a typical family of those days?
Well, I think it must have been, but it didn't seem to be typical. But it was because in those days, all families, it seems to me, were living undercover. You never spoke about what was wrong in the family. I mean, you didn't hear anybody rowing. In our house, you never heard anybody rowing because you turned the wireless up instantly. The minute you came home from school, my job was to turn the wireless on. And that was because my father could arrive at any moment and start some terrible row about anything. I mean, he was a very... depressed man, so he could have a terrible row. And the shame was not the row in the house, it was in case the neighbours heard. So that's why my entire childhood was dominated by listening to the radio.
And presumably going to the cinema, because we have a thrill from watching a film star next. Does this simply represent the excitement of going to the pictures, or is it this particular performer?
It's both. I mean, we went every Saturday afternoon without fail, unless my father was in one of his paddies. We went to Southport, which has a huge long row, well, they used to have, of beautiful palaces, cinemas.
When I grow up in a year or two or three, I'll be happy as can be, like a birdie in the tree. When I grow up, there's a lot I want to do. I will have real dollies too, like the woman in the shoe. I want to be a teacher so the children can play. Oh, teacher dear, the gang's all here with apples today. When I grow up, I will have a big surprise, for I'll bake the kind of pies that will make you roll your eyes. And if you see that you need some company, you can call me up and I'll come down when I grow up.
I loved her. You know, Shirley Temple had the most incredible effect on children of my generation because, well, on their parents, actually, not so much on us, but it rubbed off on us, because it didn't half improve the way our parents dressed little girls. I mean, before that, we went round like middle-aged women with handbags and gloves and things like that, but she wore these cute little clothes, rather simple. She didn't have a good effect on people's hair, I remember. Mm. My mother dragged me off to have my hair permed like mad, because you had to try and have those fat curls all the time. But another thing Shirley Temple did was to send a whole generation to tap dancing classes. And I was sent at five to a woman in Southport who had a troupe, a Thelma Pinchbeck dancing troupe. And my first tap dance was to An Apple for the Teacher. I don't know that that was a Shirley Temple song, but I do remember that.
Is this how you fell in love with show business then, at this early age?
No, I think my mother fell in love with it. I didn't really, she saw that I was obviously going to be something quite difficult in the education stakes, so she pushed me towards having another way of getting rid of my high spirits. She was very, very sensible, actually. It was very perceptive, in a way.
And was it her, then, who you would say was responsible for you ultimately going into the theatre as a career?
I think so, yes. Mm. She sent me there. That and being pushed out of school, and they had to find somewhere for me to go. So they sent me to a ballet school in London, which I was hopeless. And then my father knew somebody at the Liverpool Playhouse, and so I got into the theatre that way.
And that was one of the top companies in those days in repertory, wasn't it?
Oh, yes,
Playhouse
it was.
Liverpool was...
Yes, if you got to the Liverpool Playhouse, you were really somebody. It was excellent because of the fact that this was, 1949, but people didn't really start coming back and getting into things till about, say, 1946 after the war. So all the really good actors went back to the Playhouse and stayed for several seasons so as to get themselves back into the feel of acting again. And it was an education.
Can you remember any particular performance from those far-off days that gave you a special thrill? I mean, either your own or watching someone else's from the wings.
Oh, not mine, because I was very sort of minor. I mean, apart from one play that I happened to be in because somebody fell out. But I think Richard II. I mean, I'm not a great particular lover of Shakespeare, which I think proves the fact that if at a certain age you see a really good production of Shakespeare, then your mind changes about the whole thing because it actually becomes alive. And I just loved Richard II. I loved the fact where, you know, poor old Richard's sitting there and he says about Christ, and he said, he in 12 found truth in all but one, I in 12,000 none. And I thought that was absolutely magnificent.
Was there any particular catalyst that brought it all to an end?
Oh, only that I got married. I mean, all I'd ever wanted to do was to get married and have children. I didn't really want a career in the theatre. And that was it.
And your next choice, 1949, I see, is the date. This must be from that time as well.
Yes, yes, yes. It is, of course, your dad, Ray Zilaf, that wonderful, wonderful man, who I think was streets ahead of Tommy Handley. And there's a story about this, Robin, that my father, you see, was a frightfully jealous man. And in the Radio Times, there was usually a photograph, wasn't there, of Ted? And we always used to listen to it. And my mother had, on several occasions, remarked what a wonderful show it was and what a nice chap he was. And I always think of your father, and you're sort of like him, actually, but except the hair's different now. But he had this schoolboy haircut, didn't he? He had a sort of the side parting.
Yes.
There. And he had this strange face, and he was also, this is why my mother liked him, he also wasn't common in the way that some of the other comedians were common. He was slightly, you know, slightly well-spoken in a funny sort of way. And I can always remember my mother sort of cutting a photograph out of the Radio Times. And our wireless was, it had toppled so often off the windowsill that it was patched with black adhesive tape, you see. So it was quite dicey anyway. And the adhesive tape was sort of sticky on both sides, if you know what I mean. And she very unwisely stuck this cutout of Ted on this. And in one of my father's extreme moves, he took enormous offence at this and over went the wireless again. It never broke, funny enough. It must have had vowels as strong as steel. But that, and I, the tingle factor comes into it that there must have been an occasion, I can't remember it all that well now, when after some episode, that episode, that when Raise a Laugh was turned on, I had this slight anxiety feeling that something would go wrong.
Hello, boys and girls. What do you think? What do you think? When I was coming here tonight, I saw Mr. Attlee walking down Whitehall and Mr. Morrison walking up the other way. And they passed each other and never spoke. It's come to a fine thing when they start cutting each other. You know, some people take these things very badly. There was a fellow last week just going to throw himself over Westminster Bridge when a policeman came along and said, "Hey, what's your big idea?" So this fellow said, "Well, what with the weather and the wife, and I can't stand it, I tell you. She gets me down, she gets on me."
We'll never know the end of that one, will we? Funnily enough, my father was quite a jealous man as well.
What so was he?
He might have got on with your old man all right.
That's extraordinary.
Now, round about this time, your career changed from being an actress to being a writer. Was that a sort of smooth transition?
I'd always written. And again, my mother had been amazingly sort of encouraging about this. So I'd sort of been scribbling from a very early age. And I mean, actually writing whole books, well, so-called books, you know, I'd start at page one and end at about page 100.
In longhand?
Yes, yes, and with illustrations. So it wasn't something new, but I suppose, began writing when my children were very small and one couldn't go out or couldn't afford babysitters. And so I just decided that I would really get down to doing it. So it wasn't so much a struggle then, because I'd sort of done a kind of apprenticeship before all this. So I knew what I wanted. But also, of course, again, the wireless had played an enormous part in this, because we mostly listened, and that was because the wireless was in such a shocking state. It was mostly jammed on the third programme. And you heard such wonderful things on that, you know, there's all the best plays and talks and nature studies.
I was going to ask you, you know, when you started writing books, whether there were any literary heroes or heroines whose work you particularly admired.
Well, it sounds awful, but I think I was pretty ill-read in many ways. I mean, I didn't come to all sorts of books till a long while later. I read avidly, between the ages, say, of about 14 to 18, and then promptly forgot everything I'd ever read. So I had to go back to things a bit later on. But the words must have gone in or something. I particularly liked François Mauriac, because of that Catholicism thing. But all sorts of other things. I mean, I tried Proust, and no, I couldn't manage Proust. Walter Scott, I couldn't stand. George Eliot, I didn't like. I came to the Brontes late.
And poetry.
Well, I've got a funny thing about poetry, you see. I hate modern poetry. I don't really know anything about poetry. The only poems I like are the ones I learnt at school. You see, I keep on going on about this. I think I've been caught in aspic so far back that the whole other areas of experience nowadays are blocked to me. And always I can still remember reading at school Dover Beach by Matthew Arnold, and not really understanding it, though it's not a difficult poem to understand, but I brought the book home, and then I stood in the window upstairs in my mother's room, because we all shared rooms, and read it aloud. And the first two, I think there's two stanzas at the beginning, didn't interest me, but the last verse of all still has the ability to make me want to cry. I suggest, if there are any adolescents listening, it's the one poem for melancholy adolescents to get their hands on and to mouth over and over.
Ah, love, let us be true to one another. For the world which seems to lie before us like a land of dreams, so various, so beautiful, so new, hath really neither joy, nor love, nor light, nor certitude, nor peace, nor help for pain. And we are here as on a darkling plain, swept with confused alarms of struggle and flight, where ignorant armies clash by night.
Carlton Hobbs, reading part of Dover Beach by Matthew Arnold. Beryl Bainbridge, which of your books was your first real success?
I suppose The Dressmaker, the second book, because lovely Carl Miller shortlisted it. He was one of the judges, or the chairman of the Booker Prize. I think I'm thinking of 1972, I think. And he very kindly sort of, he put me on the cover of The Listener and a photograph, you know, and I did an article on Liverpool or the past or something. And it was really from then on, I think. It wasn't, and it still isn't, success in vast copies being sold. I think they became a sort of, people have used the word cult, but I'm not so sure that I agree with that particularly. But it's that sort of thing. It was a slow building up of a body of work, I think, more than anything.
Do you write to live or live to write?
A bit of both. I mean, God knows what I'd do if I didn't write, because I'm untrained to do anything else. And
what if you had a lot of money?
I don't know that I would have a lot of money, because I think I'd give most of it away. I'm peculiar about money. I hate money. I think it's corrupting, and not for anybody else. Anybody else can have it, but for me, I don't
you
like
spending it.
Oh, yes, it's not that I'm funny about that either. No, it's all mixed up. I mean, it's to involve this, but my father was an undisclosed bankrupt, you see, and it only came out when I was, all sorts of things happened. But so there's a sort of a built-in resistance to this. That being said, I'm very comfortable. I think I would feel uneasy if I wasn't writing, but then I think I'd make things. I've always wanted to make waxworks and things like that. I made a Jesus last year. I went to France and saw those beautiful crucifixes, and I thought, right, that's what I'll do. I'll come home and do one of those. Absolutely hopeless. He's about 8 foot high, made of plaster of Paris, and I got too enthusiastic. I nailed him on the cross before he was properly dry. With the result, all the plaster of Paris falls off. There's nowhere I can put him. So he's at the top of the house, fortunately. I can't bring him down, because you'd scrape all the ceilings, because he's nailed. So he just stands there. He's terribly limp.
I think perhaps you'd better stick to writing. An unusual choice next. Now, tell me about Emily Butter. I don't know about this.
Oh, Emily Butter. Now, Emily Butter was... Emily Butter was a character in an opera called Emily Butter by a woman called Hilda Tablet, and it was on the third programme. Of course, Hilda Tablet was the writer Henry Reed, the one that wrote The Naming of Parts. And I heard it one night alone for some reason. I think my parents were out in the garden, it was summer or something, and on came this opera. Now, I didn't know much about music at all, I still don't, but as far as I was concerned, operas were terribly sort of, they were very posh. And I listened all the way through this, and it seemed to me, it wasn't that it was unmusical, but I kept on thinking I ought to be laughing, but that you couldn't laugh at an opera, it wasn't supposed to be funny. So, and then I heard that the voice of something about, and I'm sure to this day that I may be wrong, when we play it, I can be proved right, that some of the final scenes were set in a lady's lavatory. And somebody was locked in the lavatory, and I was terribly reminded of that song, you know, when you were a kid, "Oh dear, what can the matter be? Two old ladies locked in the lavatory." And so that's why, when I hear it, I shall really enjoy it.
Emily Butter, Emily Butter, she went through that door there.
Which door?
The door marked Ladies' Powder Room.
She's locked herself in.
Emily. Emily Butter!
La povera ragazza dove sta? I hope Emily's safe. She's locked in the powder room.
Oh, God! I hope she doesn't do herself a mischief in there.
part of Henry Reed's comic opera, Emily Butter. Beryl Bainbridge, having had a difficult childhood yourself, did it make it important to you that you should succeed as a mother?
Yes, but I didn't have any doubts. I thought it would be perfectly simple because I knew how to do it. Of course, I was totally wrong, but... And sometimes I feel a lot of guilt. But then I try and think, well, you know, you can't be any other way than you are. And I've got grandchildren now, lovely boys, and my daughter's a wonderful mother. And there's all sorts of things I would like to be able to tell her about what it's going to be like and how not to do it. And then, of course, you can't do that because she's producing an entirely different set of circumstances. So you can't actually win, can you?
What's your next choice?
Well, my next choice is, it's Paderewski playing the Polonaise in A-flat. And this is a very odd memory, this. There was a woman over the down over the railway line in Formby called Mrs. Criddle, who was the Tate and Lyle sugar family. They were very wealthy, but they lived like, they had lots of books, which is very odd for one thing. And they had something called the Young Communist League. And there were Bevan boys and all sorts of things. And I don't know how I got into it, but I used to go there every week. You paid sixpence a week. But when I was very young, sort of the start of the war, there was a woman rang up my mother, a woman called Mrs. Woodward, who was a friend of the Criddles, and said that Paderewski was going to be playing at Southport, and would I like to go along? And she was very pleased, you know, that I'd been mixing with this lady. So I went along and I listened to the music. I can't pretend I really remember the music. I know I was up late, as it were. But then afterwards, Mrs. Woodward took me round to meet Paderewski. I'd never seen anything like it, this extraordinary man with this huge beehive hairstyle. And I was so busy opening my eyes and sort of holding my face in a funny way to stop myself laughing because... He was very extraordinary to look at from where I came from.
And very old.
Yes. And he shook me by the hand and he looked at me and he said, "You're a very special child." And I think it was because of the most extraordinary expression I had on my face at the time that he mistook my rather mysterious look for something deeper when really I was just trying to stop laughing.
I think perhaps you were a special child.
Oh, I know.
You know, all the tingles which have come to your mind are almost exclusively from your past and many, many from your distant past at that. Are thrills harder to come by the older you get?
I think so, yes. I mean, that has obviously rather strange connotations, put like that, but I know exactly what you mean. Yes, I think that the only tingles in that sense that you get are... Well, in my case, anyway, from the past, because by the time you're 14, you're who you are, and everything after that. Oh, you may be surprised. You may all sorts of things may happen to you. You may fall in love, all that sort of thing. But all the deeper experiences, I think, the things that genuinely really move you, start much earlier on. I'm sure of that.
But you still have an appetite for some of the more frivolous things in life.
Yes, well, in particular, I just love that's the Merry Widow. Obviously you know the Merry Widow, that wonderful thing, yes. And I didn't know the opera properly. until I thought that main song, Velia O Velia, which...
The Witch of the Wood, yes. And
which people roar out in the pub at closing time, don't they? I thought, I didn't know it belonged to any opera at all. And then I started to write a book about Adolf Hitler when young. And I read about him and discovered that The Merry Widow was his favourite opera. So I duly bought the record and, I still play it over and over and over. I bought two versions. I had a German version and an English version. I prefer the German one because, though I obviously can't understand it, it sounds so much more foreign and lively and everything. And I just, when I do play it at home, I just dance round and round the room, singing about wanting to go to gay Maxime's.
But we're still in the past with memories of Hitler.
Exactly, exactly.
Da geh ich zu Maxim, dort bin ich sehr intim. Ich duze alle Damen, ruf sie beim großen Namen. Lolo, Doro, Juju, Klo, Klo, Barga, Fru, Fru. Sie lassen mich vergessen, das Feuer. Mit allen diesen Süßen, Lolo, Doro, Juju, Klo, Klo, Barga, Fru, Fru, dann kann ich leicht vergessen, dass...